I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Today on the show, the fight over the right to vote after the 2020 election. Coming up, more than 40 state legislatures have introduced bills restricting voter access, including vote by mail, stricter voter ID requirements, cutting registration options, instituting more aggressive voter roll purges. Also coming up, what is in House Bill 1, major voting rights legislation just passed by the U.S. House of Representatives. Well, as we all know, Pennsylvania was a key battleground state last year when Republicans filed multiple lawsuits charging voting irregularities, which were tossed out of court. Republicans challenged mail-in ballots, which were approved in 2019 by the Republican-controlled legislature. More recently, Republicans want to change judicial elections, creating electoral districts to replace statewide voting for judges, which critics call judicial gerrymandering. We ask Khalif Ali to join us. He is the executive director of Common Cause Pennsylvania. Khalif Ali, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, you can always join us now or throughout the hour, radiotimes at whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Khalif Ali, are all the challenges of the 2020 election in Pennsylvania, have they all been resolved?
Yes, they have all been resolved. Literally in the courts and through the legislature, but they are there are still challenges with regard to people's commitment to the outcomes of what happened.
What do you mean by that?
So there's still a belief that the results of the election and the actual process of the election are fraudulent. And we're starting to see a support of that false narrative by the actions of Republicans in the General Assembly.
In what way? What are they doing?
So Representative Seth Grove is currently holding 14 hearings on the elections, the election results, and the process associated with that election. These hearings, we don't believe that there's much merit to those hearings because much of what the hearings are being held for have been resolved in court. Right. But we believe that they lay a strong foundation for a number of bills that were mentioned leading into the show to disenfranchise voters and to roll back many of the reforms we saw occur through Act 77.
And just picking up on that, I mean, the election results were certified. I'll be talking with our guest who's going to join us in just a couple of minutes about allegations of voter fraud, which are really minuscule when you dig down. So I wonder with these hearings whether Seth Grove will find what it is that he is looking for.
Well, so I think there's something to be said. So the elections, as you indicated, were not perfect, but they were far from fraudulent. So what the hearings will probably show is that there were inconsistencies in terms of the application or the implementation of Act 77 throughout the count through the various counties, because counties manage the election process. And if we think about it, and if we put it in context and understand that the election code hasn't been changed since 1937, no. We know that there's a process that has to occur before the counties are able to adapt to a lot of the changes that have occurred through Act 77. That doesn't mean it's fraudulent. That just means there are improvements that need to be made and consistencies that have to be applied.
And Act 77 allows for mail-in voting, just so to make sure our listeners know what it is we're talking about.
Yes, yes. It allows for mail-in, no excuse mail-in voting. It's at a 50-day mail-in voting period, meaning voters can request and submit their mail-in absentee ballots up to 50 days before the election. It establishes permanent mail-in and absentee ballot lists. You sign up one time, you get your ballots for the remainder of the year. And establish, extend voter registration deadline and submission deadlines.
And that all happened before the pandemic, when so many people, felt like I need to vote by mail because, frankly, I want to limit my contact with other people.
Absolutely. This was done in 2019 through bipartisan support. And at that time, Senator Cornyn recognized the need for an improvement and a modernization of a code that hadn't been changed since 1937.
And we should add, there was a record turnout in Pennsylvania, as there were in other states. I think almost 7 million people voted. In fact, both candidates, both Biden and Trump, got more candidates than either candidate, including Trump, in 2016. So I guess that in certain ways, that's the good news, right?
Absolutely. So we have 9 million registrations. And as you just mentioned, 7 million turnout. That's over 75% of turnout. That's phenomenal. There couldn't be anything wrong with having that level of participation in the democratic process. And we want to support keeping it that way.
We do know there were attacks on poll workers. I know that happened in Pennsylvania. I'm sure it happened in other counties as well, even death threats on some poll workers. Is Common Cause and others concerned that we won't have enough electoral workers, you know, people at the polls, because they're afraid to do their job?
Well, part of election protection is to protect the workers who are managing the election process. Along with actual security associated with that, there should be appropriate training for those poll workers. Right. So we are concerned about that, and we are advocating for that. But we're also advocating for, like I said, additional training for these poll workers to help them, again, transition into the reforms and help them implement these reforms in a manner that's fair.
Training to protect them from some of these threats?
I think the training would have to be in terms of what steps are necessary to protect themselves in case of threat, yes.
Do you see, and I'll be, again, talking with about what are happening in some other states, but do you see a return of voter ID laws in Pennsylvania?
I see a return to a number of bills that would have that in place, but there are no indications that Governor Wolf would sign any such legislation, and there is no veto-proof majority in the General Assembly. So, I don't anticipate any bills passing.
And that was litigated a number of years ago, and no one was able to really convince a judge that there was voter fraud. Nonetheless, seems like an issue that will probably never go away.
No. So something that we've been concerned about in relation to that is that we want everyone to have a clear understanding of democracy. And democracy, having a good, solid, strong democracy doesn't mean we always get the outcomes that we desire. And if we don't, it doesn't mean the system's broke. It could mean that we need to talk about this system, that we need to adjust it, we need to make necessary reforms, but we still have a very, very solid system in place.
Let me ask you about, and this is, I believe it's House Bill 38, but this is a proposal from Republicans to, this gets a little complicated, but to replace statewide elections for judges, which we do in Pennsylvania, with
right.
judicial districts that would be, as yes. I understand it, drawn by the legislature, which now is controlled by the GOP. Help us understand what's happening here.
So from my understanding, the appellate courts of Pennsylvania, which are the three highest courts in Pennsylvania, Commonwealth, Superior, and Supreme Court, have rendered decisions against Republicans with regard to their issues and their concerns related to the elections. They're not happy about that, and we see this bill as not about real legislation, but about punishing the courts for rendering decisions in favor of the outcomes of those elections.
You're saying payback.
Yes, this is payback. We believe that, well, the Constitution calls for the judiciary to be impartial in judging the law. They don't report. They don't have constituents. The law is their constituent. And it's so important for them to remain independent and fair in their interpretation of the law. That doesn't mean they have values or elite or, you know, or sign up with a particular party, but it means that they are very independent and they don't have to report to any constituents with regard to their interpretation of the law. So we're playing a very dangerous game when we put the judiciary in the same type of boat as the legislature is in terms of running, in terms of all the different decisions that they make to maintain their seat. That's a very dangerous game that's being played.
The arguments coming, or there are several coming from Republicans, but one is that the way it is now with statewide voting is that you, because where do people live in Pennsylvania? Largely in the Philly area, largely in the Pittsburgh area. So you get judges that essentially are connected or have ties to that part of the state, leaving some of the rural counties without what they feel is representation.
Right. So I don't have the list in front of me, but there aren't as many judges from the Philadelphia and Allegheny County areas. We tend to think there are also judges from Montgomery County and from a number of other counties throughout the state of Pennsylvania. So that is a narrative that's not true. There is a broad range of judges from various parts of the state, including counties that stretch into rural areas. So we don't believe that that's an accurate statement at all.
We're almost out of time here, but that would require amending the Constitution, so that issue would be put before the voters, correct?
Yes, absolutely. So it would take it would have to pass through the General Assembly twice. It's passed through once. It's on a second go-around in the House. It would have to pass the House and then the Senate, and then it would be put on the ballot for consideration by the people of Pennsylvania. It doesn't require the governor's signature.
And that would be, I mean, probably wouldn't make it this year, but maybe in some future, We're almost out of time here. How about the census data, which of course has been delayed in many ways because of the pandemic. What's the status on that?
So it's scheduled to be released September 30th, if I'm not mistaken. So that will put the Legislative Redistricting Commission in a position where they would have to generate a preliminary map by December 29th, which is very tight. So we're hoping that the Legislative Redistricting Commission will come together and begin the process of soliciting public input before the data is released so that they can come up with maps that are fair and impartial, or I'm sorry, fair and represent the interests of the people of Pennsylvania.
Khalif Ali, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's Khalif Ali, and he is Executive Director of Common Cause Pennsylvania. We've got two more guests. They'll be joining us after this very short break. We'll be talking about the fight over the right to vote after the 2020 election. It's still happening. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. While the results of the 2020 election are final, a battle is brewing in Congress and in a number of states over voting. Last week, the House of Representatives passed House Bill 1, For the People Act, expanding voter protections for federal elections. Its fate in the Senate is uncertain, largely because of the filibuster. Meanwhile, according to the Brennan Center, Republican legislators in some 43 states have introduced more than 250 bills to restrict voter access. The U.S. Supreme Court just heard an Arizona case about ballot access, and on Sunday, President Biden issued an executive order promoting voting rights. So today on Radio Times, the fight over the right to vote. And joining us is Eliza Swearin Becker. She's Voting Rights and Election Counsel at the Brennan Center. And Eliza Swearin Becker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. She's joining us by Skype.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us, Ari Berman, and he's senior reporter for Mother Jones covering voting rights, wrote a book called Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari Berman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty, thank you for having me back.
You're welcome. And let me just make sure that our listeners can join us anytime during this hour. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me just do a very quick recap about what happened since November 2020. We had a record turnout amid the pandemic, multiple challenges in courts, rulings by lower courts, the U.S. Supreme Court certifying the results of the election. I'm talking about the presidential election. We had a certification amid an insurrection. We had an inauguration, which Trump has never conceded that he lost the race. We do have a new president. His name is Joe Biden. Ari Berman, let me put this to you. Can we say that the system held, or that the system is wounded, or both, or one or the other?
Well, the system worked in 2020, Marty, against all odds, against a pandemic, against the weakening of the United States Postal Service, against a lot of people unsure and afraid about how to vote. We had record turnout, the highest turnout in 120 years, the highest turnout since 1900, which is even more remarkable considering that so many people couldn't vote in 1900, including women and most people of color, and we were just entering Jim Crow. And I think it's that high turnout and that progress that was made that really threatens a lot of people in power. And so they are trying to roll the voting methods that were used so successfully in 2020 back. They're trying to make it harder to vote by mail after so many people voted by mail for the first time. They're trying to cut early voting, even though so many people used early voting. 80% of votes were cast early or through the mail in 2020. And of course, they're also trying to add new requirements like voter ID and things like that they've been pushing before. And so instead of high turnout becoming the new normal, people in power are threatened by this, and they want to make elections have lower turnout and less participation instead of more turnout and higher participation.
And I want to get to that. Eliza, let me put to you, though, we've got millions of people. These are largely Trump supporters. They do not accept these election results. They see Joe Biden as illegitimate, which is different from being disappointed that the candidate that you voted for lost. We know that Trump will never concede. How much has that hurt our electoral system and even our democracy?
Well, I think what you're reflecting is that the former president and others really poisoned the atmosphere around our democracy and around voting and have perpetuated lies about voter fraud, lies about election irregularities that are themselves rooted in racist notions about whose ballots should be valid. And that continues to, you know, poison the legislative sessions of states across the country now, because we have state lawmakers using those lies to justify all of the restrictions that Ari just mentioned. So I think it is really harmful what the former president and others have sowed. And they're creating this atmosphere of, you know, purported concern about fraud. And that concern, of course, is again based on these meritless lies. And now lawmakers are pointing to that public concern as the basis for these voter suppression bills. So it's a really sort of perverse, anti-democratic circular logic that we're seeing.
But Eliza, and I'm sure Ari, you want to jump in on this as well, but why have those lies endured? And I ask that because there have been multiple examinations, Brennan Center being one, but others as well, that have looked at, you know, just how widespread is voter fraud. And it's minuscule. And yet there is this belief, maybe, you know, nurtured and promulgated by people who don't like the results. But nonetheless, it does endure. And why do you think that is, Eliza?
I think that lie is being perpetuated by political leaders and speakers in the media whom many Americans trust. And it is the responsibility of those leaders to tell the truth, and they're simply not doing that. So we as advocates, other leaders across the country are trying to get the message through that those allegations are simply lies. But it's also on, you know, the the talking heads in the media and on current officials and former officials to correct the record, because it is really poisonous to our democracy.
I mean, Ari, your book is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. This struggle has kind of defined us as a democracy.
It has defined us as a democracy for a very long time. We have a very long history of preventing people from voting in this country, all the way back from the founding of our country when only white male property owners could vote. And that's what makes the current attack on voting rights so disturbing. The fact that 253 bills have been introduced in 43 states in 2 months is a dramatic rollback of voting access after the highest turnout election in 120 years. And to answer your earlier question, so many people believe the lies because some people just keep repeating them over and over, namely Donald Trump and his enablers in the extreme right-wing media ecosystem. These are not people that trust NPR or the New York Times or all of the reputable outlets. They listen to Fox News, they listen to OANN, they listen to Newsmax, and they're being told things that are untrue over and over. And to me, this was never actually about voter fraud. This is believing that Democratic victories are illegitimate. And in particular, Democratic victories that are powered by people of color are illegitimate. Because if you look at the places they're attacking, it's Philadelphia, it's Detroit, it's Atlanta, it's Phoenix. It's all of these urban areas with large populations of people of color. And those are the places they're singling out to try to throw out votes and now to try to restrict voting in those places. So it was never about election integrity. It was never about voter fraud. It was always about the belief that Democratic victories are illegitimate. That is what is powering this new wave restricting voting rights.
Let me pick up on that and go back to you, Eliza. If more Democrats vote, how do I ask this? Sorry. I mean, if you make voting easier and with fewer barriers and restrictions, do you get more Democrats who vote or do you get more Republicans who vote?
I think that the question sort of reflects how partisan the issue of voting rights has become. Whether voting should be free, fair, and accessible shouldn't be about whether it benefits Republicans or Democrats. Right. The right to vote is sacrosanct. We should be protecting it. We should ensure everyone can access it, regardless of the partisan gain that is expected from a policy that would make it easier for Americans to vote. So I hesitate to sort of dive into that gain because I think it is just reflects the sort of cynical partisan efforts that we're seeing across the country where state lawmakers are introducing bills to make it harder to vote because they think it's going to give them a partisan advantage. But the fact is that prior to last year, voters of both parties took advantage of mail voting, for example, in relatively equal numbers. And cutbacks on access to mail voting may hurt Republicans just as much as Democrats, because the way that people used mail voting last year in 2020, a very anomalous year during a pandemic, may not be what we see going forward.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Eliza Swearin-Becker. She's Voting Rights and Election Counsel at the Brennan Center. Also with us, Ari Berman. He's a senior reporter at Mother Jones, and he covers voting rights. And we're talking about the ongoing fight over the right to vote. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to talk about the House bill, but let me put something to you, Ari, and this has to do with the case that was argued recently before the U.S. Supreme Court involving Arizona and some voting restrictions. The lawyer for the Republican Party said that voting restrictions would help the GOP win, saying that politics is a zero-sum game. That reminded me of something that House Majority Leader Mike Terzai said in Pennsylvania in 2012, that voter ID laws would help Romney beat Obama in Pennsylvania. And I just wonder if you could speak to those two messages about voting restrictions.
Well, it seems like over and over, Republicans are saying the quiet part out loud here, that they're saying that they benefit from these restrictions on voting. You had a member of the state Senate in Wisconsin say a similar thing, that they were going to carry the state in 2016 because they had voter ID in place for the first time. You had Donald Trump say very publicly that Republicans could never get elected if we made it easier to vote. And then you had a Republican lawyer before the Supreme Court say that when you struck down restrictions on voting, it put them at a competitive disadvantage. And that was a pretty remarkable thing to say before the Supreme Court, because you're supposed to make legal arguments before the Supreme Court, not political arguments. And so the fact that the Republican Party was trying to weaken the Voting Rights Act to try to gain a political advantage is very disturbing. I mean, you're talking about trying to weaken the most important voting rights law ever passed in this country, which has already been severely gutted by the Supreme Court. And they're basically saying, we need to do this to put us at a competitive advantage in the election. That is not what the Voting Rights Act was designed for. The Voting Rights Act was not designed to benefit one political party or another. It was designed to prevent voters from facing discrimination after hundreds of years in this country in which Black people, Latinos, so many others couldn't vote because of discriminatory voting measures. And so a lot of history is repeating itself here in a very ugly way.
Let me go back to you, Eliza, and let's talk about this House bill that was passed last week, H.R. 1. I think it's something like 800 pages. What are which I won't ask you to go through page by page, but nonetheless, what are the sort of basic provisions that this bill is calling for?
Well, as you note, it's an omnibus democracy reform bill, but it has key provisions with respect to voting, provisions that would make it easier to register to vote and stay on the rolls, like automatic voter registration and election day registration and protections against erroneous purges. There are provisions that make it easier to vote, like no excuse mail voting for everyone and early voting for everyone in federal elections. The bill would restore voting rights to every American living in the community, regardless of past convictions. And the bill would end partisan gerrymandering. So the bill takes a lot of steps to protect the right to vote, to make common sense election reforms that some states across the country have already implemented with great success, and to give all Americans access to those, you know, common sense methods of registering and voting that so many Americans have already taken advantage of.
And Ari, what do you think the fate of this bill will be in the U.S. Senate?
Well, it passed the House, and the only way it's going to pass the U.S. Senate is if Democrats get rid of the filibuster to pass it, because there's no way it's going to receive 60 votes in the Senate, which would mean 10 Republican votes. Mitch McConnell has already said he doesn't want a single Republican to vote for this. So Democrats face a really big choice right now. All across the country, Republicans are restricting voting rights in a way that H.R. 1, the For the People Act, could stop by making it easier to vote in a whole bunch of different ways that Eliza discussed. If Democrats don't get rid of the filibuster, they're basically going to allow Republicans to undermine democracy unchecked. And I talked, for example, to Stacey Abrams this week, the voting rights leader in Georgia. And she told me that she believes Democrats should eliminate the filibuster specifically to pass these voting rights bills, to pass H.R. 1 and a companion bill, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. Because in the same way that Congress has unique power, for example, to appoint judges or to pass budget bills with a simple majority vote, she believes that the protection of voting rights, which is fundamental to democracy, should also be passed by a simple majority, not subject to a 60-vote supermajority. And that is an argument that I think Democrats are going to make increasingly as voter suppression at the state level gets worse.
Let me go back to you, Eliza, and this will reveal, I guess, my ignorance here. But, I mean, states and even counties largely run elections. So what would House Bill 1 actually do on the state level?
Well, that's right, in that the U.S. Constitution does give states the authority to regulate federal elections. But the same provision of the Constitution gives Congress the power to make new election rules for federal elections or even to alter state rules. And so that's why we have, you know, incredibly important civil rights reforms like the Voting Rights Act to begin with, like the National Voter Registration Act. So it's well within Congress's power to regulate federal elections, and it's something that Congress has done for a very long time. So H.R. 1 would implement the reforms that I talked about for federal elections across the country. And those reforms would take precedence. They would be supreme over state laws that were in conflict or didn't provide the same protections to voters.
All right, here's a question from Paul. He says, are the Democrats going too far with felons voting? It should be say, as I understand it, that after you've served your time, you get your voting rights back. But nonetheless, he says 16-year-olds voting, I'm not sure about that, not purging voter rolls of people who have moved, et cetera. Can you speak to some of those concerns?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of misinformation in that question. The bill restores voting rights to people that have already served their time, people with past felony convictions that have already served their time. That's something that a lot of states already do, and it's something that's broadly popular among political lines. The bill does not give 16-year-old and 17-year-olds the right to vote, and it does not ban voter purging. What it says is that you cannot be purged simply for missing one or two elections, that you actually have to have moved or die or done something to actually make you ineligible to vote. Voting, that not voting should not make you ineligible. And the interesting thing about this bill is it's been called a power grab by Democrats, but it's broadly popular. 68% of Americans support it. When you go through individual provisions, things like independent redistricting, public financing of elections, early voting, automatic registration, these are very popular provisions. These are provisions that are supported by 60, 70, 80% of voters. And as Eliza said, this doesn't benefit one party or another. Utah has a very expansive voting system. They have universal vote by mail. They make it very easy to register to vote and cast a ballot. And Republicans do just fine in Utah, and Republicans like the system there. So the idea that you're going to enact these reforms and only Republicans are only Democrats are going to use them is simply not true. And what happened in the last election was we had record turnout among all voters, meaning that Republicans benefited from expanded mail voting. Republicans benefited from early voting. Republicans benefited from automatic registration. That's why I find the GOP's position on this so puzzling. Yes, Trump lost, but they did very well in a lot of states. They did very well in a lot of congressional races. And they showed that in a high turnout election, they can compete very effectively.
Let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Ari Berman, also with us, Eliza Swearin-Becker. And we're talking about the fight over, frankly, the right to vote. Ari Berman is senior reporter at Mother Jones. He covers voting rights. Eliza Swearin-Becker is voting rights and election counsel at the Brennan Center. And again, we always want to hear from you. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the fight over the right to vote, especially after the 2020 election. There have been numerous bills introduced in state legislatures to restrict voting. The House has also voted to expand voter protections. The U.S. Supreme Court just heard an Arizona case about ballot access. And on Sunday, President Biden issued an executive order promoting voting rights. So we are still fighting over this right to vote. And again, joining us, Ari Berman from Mother Jones and Eliza Swearin-Becker from the Brennan Center. Eliza, let me go back to you. And I went to the Brennan Center website and looked at some of the things that you are doing. You say voting should be simple, convenient, and fair. What would make voting simple, convenient, and fair? What do we need?
Well, what we need are actually some of the provisions that are in H.R. 1. We need mechanisms that make it easy for Americans to get registered to vote. In too many states, the burden is on the voter to figure that out. But H.R. 1 would implement automatic voter registration, which effectively means that when Americans interact with state agencies like the DMV, they would be registered to vote unless they affirmatively opt out. So that's one thing that would make it easy. Another thing that would make it easy is clear rules, for example, on how to vote by mail, like making it available to all Americans. So many Americans took advantage of vote by mail last year. It's clear that it's a very popular policy. And there is no good reason to limit mail voting to just a few groups of people that qualify with absentee reasons. Election day registration would be a huge measure that would make it simpler and easier for Americans to both register and vote, so that if somebody missed the registration deadline, but they realized how important the election was, they could still show up on election day, get registered, and once their eligibility was confirmed, their vote would count. So those are a couple of measures that would make it easier for all Americans to be registered and to cast their ballots. There are, you know, a whole slew of other reforms, again, that H.R. 1 includes. But we're leaving so many votes on the table with millions of Americans that are unregistered and don't participate. And we should be doing everything we can to bring more Americans into the democratic process, because our democracy works best when all of us participate, when our elected representatives are in fact representative of their constituents, and that we can hold them accountable for their votes and the policies that they put forth.
Ari, is this an argument for a kind of one-size-fits-all system of voting, so that what happens in Pennsylvania will also be true in Florida or true in Alabama or in Washington State?
Well, I think obviously states have a lot of power in our decentralized system to run their own elections. But I think what H.R. 1 recognizes and what the John Lewis Voting Rights Act recognizes is that there needs to be federal protection for voters, so that your right to vote isn't dramatically different based on where you live. So that if you live in Oregon, for example, it's very easy to vote by mail. But if you live in Texas, it's virtually impossible to vote by mail. That violates fundamental rights, and that there should be basic guarantees for federal elections where Congress has the power to do that are broadly popular and that will help all voters. And I think things like making it easy to register and giving people more time and opportunities to vote makes sense no matter what state you live in. And then I think blatantly discriminatory actions, there has to be some sort of check to that, so that we don't go back to the pre-1965 era of voting, where if you lived in New York City, it might not be that difficult to vote. But if you lived in Alabama or Mississippi, it was nearly impossible for African Americans to vote. That's exactly what the Voting Rights Act was trying to get rid of. The fact that it was easy to vote in some states, but nearly impossible for some groups to vote in other states. And we're moving back, unfortunately, to that day, where if you live in Republican-controlled states in particular, there's this dramatic rollback of voting rights. But if you live in Democratic-controlled states, it's now becoming easier to vote. And then if you live in states like Pennsylvania, there's just complete gridlock and they can't get anything done, or they actually do get something done, like mail voting, which almost everyone supports, and then it doesn't work for one party, or it's perceived as not working for one party, and then they want to get rid of something that they all just voted for. And so this polarized situation for voting rights in this country is really, really bad for voters, no matter which party they identify with. It's going to lead to reduced voting opportunities and a situation where your right to vote depends so much on the state in which where you live.
Eliza, let me read an email from Andrew, who says, efforts to make it harder to vote are a solution in search of a problem. Many of them have a disparate impact on communities of color, low-income people, young people, and persons with disabilities. These efforts are transparently partisan. Do you agree?
Yes, that's absolutely right, that policies that make it harder to vote disproportionately burden voters of color and other marginalized communities like voters with disabilities. So, for example, a voter ID law, we know that voters of color tend to not have the required ID in higher rates than white voters, for example. Also, voter ID laws require somebody to go to a government agency and get the ID, something that may not be accessible for all voters with disabilities. And then the kinds of IDs that are required are themselves a reflection of discriminatory policy choices. For example, in Texas, a license to carry a gun is a qualifying voter ID, while a university ID is not. And of course, Texas's Wow. university population is much more diverse than the population of those carrying gun licenses. So all of these proposals to restrict voting access are going to harm voters of color more and those that are part of marginalized communities more. And I think that reflects the general attitude toward voters of color that we saw last year. As Ari discussed, the allegations of voter fraud were targeted to cities with big Black voting populations. So what is going on here is sort of as old as the country itself, which is voter suppression that is aimed at trying to make it harder for Black and brown voters to get to the ballot box.
Here's a comment from Jennifer Ari. I put it to you. She says, as an independent, I feel that my voting is restricted with no primary voting, and that is certainly true in Pennsylvania. And she says, now that 50% of Americans identify as independent, this should be addressed. Does that change either House Bill 1 or any of this legislation making its way through either legislatures or Congress?
I'm not familiar if that part of it is addressed by H.R. 1. I personally favor open primaries because I think a lot of people increasingly do identify as independents. But I think for voting more broadly, the kind of reforms we're talking about would open up the system to people no matter what their affiliation is. And so independents would benefit from early voting or automatic registration or election day registration or expanded mail voting as much as anybody would. And so these reforms are not specific to certain groups of voters. And I think that's sometimes a mistake we make when we talk about voting rights. We seem to frame it as expanding voting rights helps Democrats and restricting voting rights helps Republicans. And obviously the parties seem to believe that, particularly Republicans seem to believe that restricting voting rights benefits them. But I think it's more about opening up voting rights benefits all voters, and restricting voting rights hurts all voters, and then it falls more squarely on certain voters more than others. But it's certainly true that if you look at what is motivating a lot of these efforts to restrict voting rights, it's that a lot of people showed up in 2020 who didn't show up before. That's why we had higher turnout. And a lot of them were independent-minded voters that may not have identified strongly with one party or another, but felt very strongly about the issues facing the country and that are going to want to participate in the future. And if we start to roll back mail voting, roll back early voting, roll back election day voting, that's going to mean that fewer people of all stripes participate in elections.
Eliza, here's an email from Simon. He says, why didn't all election, basically saying, can we make Election Day a national holiday? And would that, do you think, increase voter turnout? And there are plenty of people who work and, you know, they can't afford to be either standing in line, and unfortunately we have too much of that, or to get off work to be able to go, or get childcare to be able to go and vote.
Yeah, I think any policy that is going to give people more flexibility in voting is going to help people turn out. For example, we know that policies like no excuse mail voting and early voting increase turnout because the political science literature shows that when you lower the burden or the cost to people, and by cost, I mean time, I mean distance to a polling place, I mean the difficulty of the paperwork, when you lower that cost and that burden, more Americans turn out. So any provision that is going to make it more available to get to the polling place, whether it's early voting or an Election Day holiday, those are the kind of policies that are going to help Americans get to the polls and break down barriers in the way.
Ari, you mentioned Stacey Abrams in Georgia, and I wonder how much you think Georgia is a bit of a bellwether when it comes to the right to vote. We know that it was, you know, a very close election, resulting in two Democrats winning two Senate seats. We also know that President Trump called the Secretary of State to see if they could find him, you know, just one more vote than what Biden had in Georgia. That, of course, is under investigation. But how much should we keep our eyes on Georgia, even if we're up here in Pennsylvania?
Well, Georgia is absolutely a bellwether, not just because of its long history of Jim Crow, but because of its changing demographics. Georgia is the future of the country in terms of how the demographics of the state are changing. Voters of color make up 40% of the electorate there. It will soon, in the not too distant future, become a state in which white people are in the minority. That is a trend that is happening all across the country, and I think is driving a lot of these restrictions on voting as a reaction to demographic change. It was a state where Donald Trump tried very hard to overturn the results of the election, and it's a state in which Donald Trump's lies are being weaponized by Republicans to try to make it harder to vote. And that same kind of thing is happening in Pennsylvania. It's happening in Arizona. It's happening in Iowa, and it's happening all across the country. And it's interesting because one of the things that Donald Trump told the Secretary of State in Georgia was to find 11,000 votes to be able to overturn Joe Biden's victory. And now the legislature is essentially trying to find 11,000 votes through voter suppression. to reduce methods that Democrats used effectively in the last election, including vote by mail, including early voting. And the fascinating thing about Georgia is that Republicans wrote the entire voting system there. They wrote the law expanding mail voting. They wrote the law doing early voting. And now they're trying to get rid of those things that they benefited from and advocated for simply because it benefited Democrats in one election or two elections, if you consider the November election and the runoffs. And that's just a very dangerous thing, this idea that you would open up access for all people. But the minute it didn't benefit your party, you would dramatically reduce it. I think that's fundamentally anti-democratic if you think about this country's history.
And Eliza, are there other states that the Brennan Center that you are keeping an eye on, maybe similar to Georgia, where there are efforts to limit or restrict voting?
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly Georgia leads the country or trails the country, depending on how you look at it, in the sheer volume of bills to restrict voting access. But we're also seeing a big push in Arizona to limit voter access, in Texas as well. There are bills. The Iowa governor just signed a bill to limit early voting there, notwithstanding that it was a very successful policy with, you know, no ill effects. So these efforts to restrict voting access are happening all over the country. But I think it's worth noting that states like Georgia and Arizona and Texas are states that have already very diverse populations, and they are becoming less white faster than most of the rest of the country. So I think that this restrictive effort, this wave of voter suppression bills, is also a reaction to the browning of America and the perception of how that affects partisan politics.
Do you see, I mean, this is looking in your crystal ball, Eliza, but do you see if the restrictions really become draconian and prevent people from voting, that all these cases will end up, or one of them will end up before the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, we're already starting to see legal challenges. The law that was signed in Iowa has already been challenged in court. I think a case was filed yesterday. So I think certainly there will be litigation following the passage of some of these restrictive measures. But exactly where that litigation will go is hard to predict. And it, of course, particularly depends on what happens in the Brnovich case that is now under consideration before the U.S. Supreme Court, and also what happens with the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, which would restore the preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act and could have an effect on the kinds of bills that are being advanced through state houses across the country now.
Are you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think that a lot of Democrats don't have a lot of faith in the court to protect the voting rights, given that it was a 5-4 Supreme Court that gutted the Voting Rights Act. It was a 5-4 Supreme Court that said that partisan redistricting, partisan gerrymandering can't be even reviewed by the federal courts. It was a 5-4 Supreme Court that upheld voter purging in Ohio, and now it's a 6-3 court. So it's hard to imagine the Supreme Court taking a expansive view of voting rights, even though they prevented Donald Trump from stealing the election. I think they're going to be largely sympathetic to these Republican efforts to make it harder to vote. And that's why congressional legislation is so important. That's why there's such a big push to pass the For the People Act, H.R. 1, and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, because there's a recognition that if Democrats don't do it now, they might not get another chance to do it. They might be out of power in 2022 or 2024. So this might be their best chance in a long time to pass these kind of reforms. And if they don't pass them, it's very unlikely that you're going to look for a conservative-dominated court where Donald Trump has made 234 appointees to protect voting rights instead.
We have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times, talking about such an important issue, the right to vote. Ari Berman, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. He's senior reporter at Mother Jones. He covers voting rights, wrote a book called Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Eliza Swearin-Becker, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And again, Voting Rights and Election Council at the Brennan Center. And we appreciate all those comments to Radio Times. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.